Welcome to Straight Up, brought to you by Peak Prosperity, which values context, curiosity, and learning that leads to action. Reading from his latest works and expanding on current events in the economy, energy, and environment, it is my pleasure to introduce your host, Dr. Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Straight Up. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and now we're going to be going into part two of a report that came out, a pair of reports that came out on Friday, August 9th, 2019, and this is the version for subscribers. The title of this, Defending Against the Global Currency Crisis. What to plan for as the printing presses resume at full speed. Now, the first piece was really talking about the connection of a couple of dots, which I work very hard to try and push out there into the world. One is that everything we hold near and dear is really dependent on energy. It's energy, energy that provides us everything you look, can touch, taste, eat, consume, want, desire, everything that in our world of humanity is really defined by energy. Same as for any other organism, right? And, you know, if a hawk is busy trying to catch squirrels, it better catch more squirrels in terms of energy than it spent trying to get those squirrels. Any organism that spends more than it gets back ends up dying out. And so the amount of energy we get from fossil fuels is extraordinary, and it delivers so much to us, and we're depending on that abundance continuing forever, but it can't. And we have an economy that's predicated completely, totally, wholly, particularly financial assets, on this idea that we can grow exponentially forever, that there's always going to be more energy. So part one was really setting out the idea that no, that's not the case. And I also made the case there that what you really want in times like these is to be into hard assets, which is things like farmland, timberland, productive real estate. Gold and silver is the easiest things, stuff like that. But really anything that represents actual, tangible, real wealth, because everything that's called wealth in our current so-called modern society is actually a claim on wealth. So getting that distinction right, really important, especially at turning points like this. Now, this is a really big turning point we're coming up to. The long sweep of financialization, it begins way back in the first few years after Nixon slammed the gold window and set the world adrift. Now, that was August 15th, 1971. That move alone kicked off the great wave of financialization. Why? Because, well, financial assets are no longer tethered by anything except our fantasies and imaginations, right? You're not tied to anything hard at that point in time, after August 15th, 71. Well, this has created a lot of really wealthy people, entire classes of people who are very wealthy now, but also other classes of people and even generations that are now losers. And the pain of that financialization is yet to be felt, because here's the thing about financialization. It looks fancy. It's sexy. Oh my God, look at these people who are amazing hedge fund operators and these private equity people and all this. You know, look at the CEO of this company that just leveraged their balance sheet and drove their stock prices to new highs. Well done. You know, we love these people. But financialization at its core is simply using money to make more money. It doesn't actually have to have any products, goods, services, larger social benefit tied into it. Financialization is using money to make money. And it got so grotesque and overt that we saw that even former manufacturing giant powerhouses like General Electric was really a manufacturing company with a big bolted onto the side of a giant financial firm, General Motors. It's really a financial company that has a car company bolted on the side. The cars are the means by which they use finance to secure their profits and things like that. So financialization, this allowed corporations, allowed the government, households to just go deeper, deeper, and deeper into debt. And that debt binge has extended the day of reckoning. And it did that in large measure by pulling forward a lot of demand, right? You can go into debt today and consume today, but you got to pay it back tomorrow. Well, that tomorrow keeps getting kicked off. And the other phrase for that is kicking the can down the road. That's what we've been engaging in for what feels like forever, but historically, it's actually the blink of an eye. It actually all started after August 15th, 1971. It's a really important concept to understand, and it didn't get kicked off and get started. It took a while to build up a head of steam, and now it's just roaring along at this point in time. And look, there's nothing wrong with debt as long as it's put to productive uses, Things like cash flowing rental properties, expanding plant capacity, maybe gaining new skills that offer higher future income streams to an individual. Those, they're all fine. Well, with the caveat that the future arrives exponentially larger as expected. You know, as I wrote in part one, remember, that may not be such a solid bet anymore. If the future is smaller, then being on either side of debt, either as borrower or lender, could be a big financial disappointment, right? It will be for somebody, guaranteed, if we have, $300 trillion of debt outstanding, forget the IOUs, outstanding in the world, that's a bet that the future is going to be bigger. Well, what if it's not? Well, what if only $290 trillion of that could be paid back somehow? Well, then $10 trillion is losses. Who took those losses? Well, we don't know. Somewhere borrowers, lenders, both could get really, really financially disappointed in that story, and will, according to me. Even under the best of circumstances, debts should come. It should come with some sort of a discount. That is a rate of interest applied. And that rate of interest will reflect three things. One, the risks involved. Two, the value of money over time. And three, inflation. Let's start with number one. Everything is risky. The student you loaned money to might get hit by a bus or decide to travel to regional Burning Man shows instead of working and therefore not be able to pay you back. Restaurants close, people lose jobs, companies lose their focus and fold. Such is life. Look, if there's a 5% chance of not getting paid back across an entire universe of lending, then there needs to be at least a 5% rate of interest on that universe of lending just to break even. Now, that's called the risk premium. Very well understood, easy concept, right? Well, next, what if we know that inflation's running at 3%? Well, then that's kind of the lowest rate of return you would accept if you want to remain neutral in this story. I guess you could say it's far better to hold a 3% bond than cash in this situation. You know, with cash, you lose 3% of your purchasing power, guaranteed. Boop. But with the bond, well, you remain flat. But the minimum an investor should accept on their bond holdings is the rate of inflation. And this is called the inflation premium. So putting those two concepts together, we would say the risk premium plus the inflation premium added together equals the minimum amount a sane investor should be willing to accept for lending their money. So if we said it was a 5% risk premium and a 3% inflation premium, 5 plus 3 would be 8. We would expect 8%. And then lastly, on the third concept, if you value having $1,000 today more than you value having $1,000 in a year, then your money has a time value. You know, why would I loan you $1,000 for a year if that's all I was going to get back? A 0% rate of interest on that money, that's what $1,000 now versus $1,000 a year represents, 0% rate of interest. Well, that implies if I have that zero rate, it implies that my money has no value over time, has no use. Well, of course it has some use. If I have that money myself, then at least it gives me liquidity value, meaning if I get in trouble or I need access to funds or I come across a good investment, there's an opportunity cost to not having money in my possession. So there has to be at least some time value of money. In a 0% bond, you know, that's a weird thought. But it's not quite as odd as a negative yielding bond, which says money has less than no value over time. Now, that's an oddity we're really going to explore in detail in just a minute. As well, I could also say if bonds are offering zero, well, I have other choices, such as the stock market, commodities, or productive land, productive hard assets of any kind, right? Now, you and I may well have a different time value to money that we apply, but we both have one, right? There's got to be something. So then adding up the entire equation for bond yields, it ought to be the risk premium plus the inflation premium plus whatever that time value of money cost is or premium is going to be for us. And that together, those three things added up, should be the rate of interest or yield that we'd be willing to offer into the market. Now, this is what central banks have destroyed and monkeyed with. They have decided for everybody that you don't get to pick those three things for yourself, the risk plus inflation plus time value. They've decided that money has a zero value or maybe even a negative value. Now, throughout all of recorded history, until just recently, just by which I mean the last 10 years, throughout all of recorded history, that equation for interest has always delivered a positive number. And that makes intuitive sense too, right? Doesn't it? Because money, it's not real wealth, but it is stored capital. If it's stored capital, then it has to have a positive value, right? Otherwise, it implies that when we work and we accumulate something that we want to store, that it has a negative value the moment we produce it. That's bizarre. That's a really weird concept. And that's what we're trying to wrap our heads around. That's what the central banks are trying to normalize. That's what all the financial press is talking about right now, saying, oh, negative rates are coming, even more negative rates, as if it's a foregone conclusion, and if it's logical, and they're trying to make sense out of it for you. But believe me, they don't. It doesn't make sense. I mean, if you believe it makes sense, then tell you what, I'm happy to send out my bank account numbers to you. I am right now in the process of accepting money in $1,000 increments today, with the promise that I'll pay you back $990 in 5 years. And guess what? Good news. As of today, there's no limit to how much money I'm willing to manage in this fashion. All of which brings us to negative yields. My silly bank account scheme that I just recounted there, it's not a scheme at all. I mean, it would be if I ran it, but it's not a scheme because that's how things are actually working right now across more than 15.6 trillion with a T dollars of global debt. So I have a chart here. If you go to the website at peakprosperity.com, you can see this chart, but hey, it's a chart of global debt, and it's just going swoosh up to that $15.6 trillion number. And it's a chart of negative yielding debt, the total value of negative yielding debt across the global landscape. Well, again, there was no such thing as negative yielding debt before the great financial crisis, but there is no other alternative right now for big money managers trapped by geography and or fiduciary rules that force them to be invested in certain types of bonds. There are now 12 countries and dozens of companies whose debt now trades with a negative yield. Now, here are the top 10 countries from Wolf Richter going down this list. Number one, Switzerland, with a minus 0.92% yield on their 10-year bond. Germany next at minus 0.53%. Denmark minus 0.49. Hey, I hear in Denmark now you can actually get a mortgage that's got a negative rate of interest attached to it. The bank pays you money. How do you make sense of something like this? And we tick down these lists, which is the Netherlands, Austria, France, Finland, Sweden, Belgium, Japan. Basically the OECD countries. All of those countries, all 10 of those that I've listed there, plus a couple more, are now in negative territory all the way out to 10 years. If you took the case of Switzerland, they're negative all the way out to 50 years. 50. Says in the year 2069, you give your money to the Swiss bank right now, and in the year 2069, they'll give you less of it back. It's just, I don't know. What do you say about that? That's just so weird. All right. To make this crystal clear, let's make this a solid example. So if you want to lend $1,000 to the Swiss government for 10 years, that'll cost you $1,096 today. So you buy that 10-year bond for $1,096, and in 10 years, you'll get your $1,000 back. Look, not only does your money not have any value for 10 years, it has a negative value across all 10 years. So ask yourself these questions about how we would price a bond and have a rate of interest that makes sense to us. Question number one, have risks gone below zero? Well, no, you can't have a below zero risk. Has inflation currently gone below zero? No, it's actually still fairly positive. Has the time value of money gone below zero? Nope. None of these things are true. And yet, here we are. So what does a negative yield environment actually mean? This is what we need to discuss. Well, it tells us first that the purchasers of these bonds are either trapped and have no choice but to buy them, or they're hoping to sell them to somebody else later for an even more ridiculous price, and consequently, more negative yield. But if you're trapped, why not just hold cash in an account at the bank? Well, that's a good question, but the only reason I can think that you might not want to do that is that you're worried that the bank might not be there in the future. You might get bailed in against your wishes, right? That's the process by which you have money in a bank, particularly in Europe where they've enshrined these bail-in rules, you get into that bank gets into trouble. And instead of getting a bailout in terms of a capital infusion from the government, they reach into the depositor accounts and take what they need from there to make themselves whole again. That's why it's called a bail-in, because they're using an inside source rather than an outside source for a bailout source of funds. All right. So I guess the thinking here is it's better to be safe in old government bonds, right? You know, and in Europe, I think this is a very legitimate concern right now. A quick peek at the stock prices for European banks reveals a really ugly sight right now. The era of super low and even negative rates has been absolutely destructive to European banks. Look, they weren't in the best of shape to begin with, but banks do particularly poorly when their capital, when their excess reserves, which they have to by law store at their central bank, in this case, the European Central Bank, when those excess reserves are being charged a negative rate of interest, it's absolutely a hole in the waterline for these ships, these banking ships. It's very destructive. Anyway, I got a chart here at the site you can take a peek at. It shows that the European bank stocks are really sick and they're right on a trend line. Their stock price is on a trend line where if they break below that, all bets are off. It means there's some gigantic systemic problem coming for Europe. And there are only a few other times in history when the EU bank stock index has been this sick. And so maybe it's better not to keep your money there. You know, a guaranteed 0.5% loss each year holding a German 10-year bond might sound pretty good compared against the possibility of a 40% or greater haircut to your overall funds that you're holding in a bank. So I think that's what a negative rate of interest in Europe means as much as anything. It means that people, institutions, entities, corporations do not trust the banking system to be the place they want to park their funds. So that's a possibility, a strong one. Plus everybody and their uncle here and their aunts and uncles, everybody in the whole family structure knows right now that the central banks are thoroughly trapped here. They can't raise rates without every possible ill befalling their carefully hatched equity, bond, and associated fiscal bubbles, right? They raise rates a little bit here, and governments get into fiscal trouble right away. Stock funds fall, and stock markets fall, and bonds crater. So that's what raising rates get them. So they can't do that, right? So that's not going to happen, which means maybe more printing, more QE, more deeply negative rates. And not one person in 7.8 billion is able to articulate what the exit strategy of that might be. Why? Because there isn't one. So they're really damned if they do, damned if they don't in this story, right? If they raise rates, well, there's a systemic crisis possibly, you know, and governments get in trouble, stocks fall, bonds fall. They can't have that. But if they keep rates low, the entire banking system gets into crisis. So a systemic crisis on this side, a systemic crisis on that side, what are you going to do? Right. Well, they're going to kick the can down the road because when you're on the horns of a dilemma, there's really no good way out. And humans being humans, yeah, we're going to ignore that as long as possible. But at least some of this money is not quite as trapped as it seems to be painted in the news. It's starting to think about gold as an alternative to all this negative nonsense. A real rate is the current rate of interest minus the rate of inflation. So if yields are less than inflation, you get a negative number, a negative real number. And when you take that real rate of interest and you chart it against the price of gold, you get a chart like this one, which is, again, at the website at Peak Prosperity in the article. But it's a wonderful chart. It shows the price of gold and then real U.S. rates highly, highly correlated. As the rates get more negative, gold goes up in price. So it's a pretty good way of understanding. And look, you could do worse here than to buy and sell gold simply according to what the negative yields are doing, the negative real rates. That's when things are relatively quiet. I think this chart's a great way to trade as long as nothing else is really blowing up. But gold has another function besides protecting against negative yields, and that's to protect against systemic financial emergencies. All right, the recession cometh. I just want to dip into the recession data here real quick. Not the recession data, a tiny fragment of it. Because, look, even though the central banks and associated governments of the world are rather desperately hoping to avoid a recession, one is coming. They always do for the same reasons. When financial conditions are easy, dumb business and household borrowing decisions are made. It's just what happens. Further, a lot of employment that we have today was borrowed into existence. Unemployment rises when the former borrowing and spending habits dry up, as they always do. Breathe in, breathe out. Spring, then summer, then fall, then winter. There are a variety of signposts we might follow, but perhaps automobiles is sufficient here. So first, I'm looking at a chart of global automobiles and auto parts output index. So this is how many of those things are being produced. Hey, guess what? We're currently at the lowest in a decade on that measure. So this is global automobiles. So that's the lowest since you know when, the Great Financial Crisis. And we have another chart next, which looks at European automotive output, and it's the lowest since, oh, look at that, the crisis, 2009. So this chart shows that European auto activity is very far into contraction, and that fits with the German industrial production and export data, both in heavy contraction mode right now. The UK economy contracted the most in the most recent quarter. And France is slipping with every report, just recently contracted more than expected on their production. So the recession, look, one's coming. It's not a worry in and of itself. Look, they happen. However, to the extent a recession puts a boot in the lower back of an aging credit cycle and gives it a shove down the stairs, now that's of concern here. So that's why I bring up the recession watch. That's all the data I'm going to go into. Just look, the autos alone are saying canary in the coal mine. It's looking woozy. So this next part is titled The Global Reset. And I really think it would take a miracle to avoid a recession at this point, given the data we've got. And the next one is going to be especially sharp and severe because so much of the expansion was fake. It was based on excessive borrowing. Well, that's called a credit cycle. That's what they are. Hey, look, credit cycles are really fun on the way up and doubly painful on the way down. We had one in 2000. That was painful when it broke. We had one in the run-up to the housing crisis that started to pop in 2007 late, but 2008 and 9. We call it now the Great Financial Crisis, or recession. But it was just another burst credit cycle. So we're on our third major credit cycle, and we're supposed to believe this time is different because, well, they've got more tools to prop markets a little longer. But ultimately, credit cycles, again, are fun, and then they're painful. And the hallmarks of a bursting credit cycle is their sharp, severe slowdown, right? Companies, households, they make abrupt decisions not to borrow anymore. It's like a light gets turned off, right? The switch gets flicked. Credit cycles, they blow bubbles, and with every bubbly era, it's all fun and games on the way up. It's just not so good on the way down. And that's worth remembering. The larger part of this story concerns the effects that financialization had on the globalization of markets. And I'm not referring to physical markets, like for bananas and radios and things like that, but global financial markets, the places where increasingly complicated and complex trading strategies were refined over the decades. One very large part of that involved the explosion of carry trades. That meant borrowing in one place to invest in another. An example would be borrowing US dollars to buy New Zealand government bonds. Right? The carry part of that trade was that borrowing in US dollars might have cost you 2% a year, but New Zealand bonds were paying out 5%, providing you with 3% of carry. Lever that up. Do that trade all day long and with as much volume as your lenders will allow, and you will get fantastically rich, making money with money. This is an aspect of financialization, right? It makes a lot of sense for Japanese pension funds to sell the yen that they might hold because the local 10-year government bond has got a negative yield. So they sell the yen, they buy euros, and they plow those euros into Italian 10-year debt, which at least has a positive yield. Right, so that's another example of a carry trade from one place to another. It's global. There's tons of money sloshing around doing these sorts of things. And all of that's fun and games and profits until and unless you get clocked by a currency reset that wipes out all your positive carry. So let's say, back to the New Zealand example, you're earning 3% carry, but the New Zealand dollar falls 4%. Whoops, you just lost. And maybe a turbocharged leverage loss too, depending on how much leverage you had on that. Another strategy we might talk about involves what are called pair trades. That example might be being long the yen and short the euro. So there's a pair trade there. Maybe your fancy pants back-tested model showed that being short gold and long Asian equities was a can't-lose proposition, well, at least historically. Whatever it was, enormous pools of money got all tied up in a dizzying array of complex interlinked trades, right? Pair trades, carry trades, you name it, all kinds of stuff, arbitrage. This era of increasing complexity and financialization was marked by increasingly vast, enormous pools of money sloshing around the globe looking for the best places to be. And very fickle, too. This money would pour over one border and then slosh back out like a tsunami, hungry for yield. And this was all well and good while things were stable. Money happily sloshed around. We had some occasional rumblings, right? We had the Asian currency crisis in 97, maybe the flash crash of the U.S. equity markets in 2010. Those are examples of these occasional rumblings to indicate that, yeah, maybe sometimes the combination of huge imbalances and speed of light computers, it could be kind of a dangerously volatile mix. The trend, however, was one of increasingly large bets denominated in U.S. dollars spread out all over the globe. One sign of a massive reset would be if the dollar suddenly rose as these bets were unwound, the local bonds and currencies sold, and the borrowed dollars all returned. And now here's where the story gets interesting. This piece, next part is titled A Warning. I had the pleasure of being interviewed by Grant Williams of Real Vision TV a few years back. Grant's an amazing person, writer, interviewer, world class. Love the guy. His business partner is Raul Pal, who I haven't met him, but I consider to be very knowledgeable, very thoughtful investor. And he brings data to the fight each day and ponders over what it might mean. And he understands that there are no certainties in this world and that you have to weigh the probabilities and that you have to understand where those probabilities are leaning. He's been at this for 30 years, so he's been successful. People who don't get that stuff right don't stay in business that long. So I consider him successful in that regard. And he recently put up on Twitter the most thought-provoking and educational thread I've seen on Twitter in a while, and I wanted to discuss it here with you today. And here's how he started. I'm quoting a tweet, quote, "A currency crisis? When the long-term charts all start pointing to a single event risk, I pay attention. When those charts are at the key level, I focus. And when they break, it's time for action. Something really big is going on," end quote. So that's how he opened this thread up. That was on August 7th, 2019. So it's pretty recent compared to when this is being recorded. His next tweet reads, quote, "We are at the most important juncture in foreign exchange markets in my entire 30-year career. The dollar appears at risk of an uncontrolled rise. Let me show you. The Fed broad trade-weighted dollar index is incredibly close to breaking the enormous cup and handle pattern at 130, barely a half a percent away," end quote. All right, people, this is really big news. It fits right in there with this idea of a gigantic global pool of money folding up the card table and heading home. And when it does that, you're going to see the dollar rise. That'll be a sign of this. The trade-weighted dollar index, that measures the dollar against the top currencies of the world in proportion to their trade volumes. For the dollar to be potentially breaking out against the entire basket of them, that's a really big seminal event. And it could mean a number of things. But if it means a reversal of the global liquidity flows supporting massive amounts of global speculation, then look out. And again, that's speculation, pair trades, carry trades, arbitrage, all this crazy stuff happening, right? It's all speculation. It's all financialization. That was a huge, gigantic tide that started on August 15th, 1971 and progressed all the way out. And what Raul Powell is hinting at here is maybe that is what's happening here. This is a seminal event risk. This isn't like, well, markets are a little unhappy. They get unhappy from time to time. He's talking about the inversion and reversion of something that's been in play for decades. That's what's actually possibly up for grabs here. So He continues. Here's another tweet. And this all translates into the largest chart pattern in the history of foreign exchange, the head and shoulders top on the ADXY, a pattern so big I can't quite get my head around the outcome. A fall of 20% or more across all Asian major currencies is what's on the table here, and we're right on the cliff of death. Well, if that comes to pass, a head and shoulders pattern, 20 years in the making, suddenly breaking down, and the chart that I in this article goes back to 1998, it would be then a huge bonfire made out of decades of financialization. I want to remind you, I put another chart in here to remind everybody, I put this chart up, I think, almost a year ago now. But as of 2017, there were nearly $4 trillion of dollar-denominated loans made to emerging markets, with over $2 trillion of those made to Asian countries. We include China, $2.6 trillion, right? So these are all emerging market countries that said, it's kind of tricky borrowing in my own currency. I really need to borrow in dollars for some reason. Seems like a safe currency, so I'm going to borrow in dollars. The problem is you got to pay those back in dollars. And if your business is over here earning yuan or South Korean won or yen or Thailand bahts, whatever those things are, as your currency weakens, it makes your loan in dollars more expensive. So it was all good on the way up. It's all cool as long as the liquidity floods are headed in. But when the tsunami heads back out, that's when the damage happens. So if those those $4 trillion of loans I just mentioned, if those just got 20% more expensive because the dollar suddenly shot higher, the resulting mess and losses will be extraordinary. Now imagine how many derivatives are built upon that event never happening, and which will provide exactly zero protection to the buyers of that insurance, because guess what? No, you can't protect against a tsunami like that. And that's really a rhetorical question, you know, and I'm asking you to imagine how many derivatives are built on that mess, because nobody knows. It's a giant, giant mess. Nobody has a clue. But it's a lot, right? Again, against this backdrop, gold has recently been mysteriously climbing without any noticeable retail participation from the West. It's the big money moving. Again, finally, it's been a long time. But it's been interesting watching that at the retail level. I think this is July data, that gold Eagle sales in the United States just fell precipitously. Like, nobody's buying gold, right? It's just astonishing. But the big money is at this point. And again, we need to understand why. So as I said before, gold has two functions. It protects during periods of negative real interest rates, nominal too, if we get those, as we have now. But that's new information to all of us. Nobody really knows what nominal interest rates mean or what they will enable or destroy as we have them. So that's part one, negative real interest rates. So own gold simply because we're in a negative interest rate environment, you'll do fine. But it has a second use, and that is it protects against systemic crises. That is, when you don't know who's solvent and who's trapped upside down in their kayak, having gold is an assurance that your asset is your asset, period. Otherwise, every single other financial asset is somebody else's liability. I mean, do you have any idea which banks are upside down on unpayable derivative positions, maybe on either side? Well, I don't. Do you know which funds have made bets that won't ever be covered? Because I don't. I mean, I just don't know these things. Even simple questions like, who owns more than $1 trillion of leveraged loans, which are a particularly pathetic, these are going to be trouble at some point. These leveraged loans are really junky. But just trying to ask, like, who owns those? That's $1 trillion. Like, who owns those? Yeah, you get super murky answers. Like, CLOs own those and other. I have this chart that I've got in here which says that's where they are. You got some retail participation in these things. Other is a big block, but the biggest block is this thing called CLOs, which are collateralized loan obligations. Well, then we might ask, well, who owns the CLOs, right? Well, that's even murkier. Kind of hard to get the answer to that straight up. Well, who's other? What's this other category? Well, we don't know that either. They may be in your money market funds. They could be tucked into all sorts of different products out there that have been packaged back up out and sold out. We just don't know. But that's what Wall Street does. Remember, it's very, very good at packaging these things up, hiding them, and then foisting them off on unwitting buyers. My guess is other includes Deutsche Bank, because for whatever reason, Deutsche Bank has a long and wonderful history of buying the worst crap at the worst times and getting in a lot of trouble for it. And it looks like they've probably done that again. Listen, it's probably just best to hold some gold while all that stuff sorts itself out. That's how my thinking goes. You know, when you don't know who the sucker is at the card table, it's probably you, right? So just grab your chips, wander off, get a drink, let the card players duke it out over there. Don't participate would be one way to approach this. All right, here's my conclusion, finally. The world's financial markets are teetering again. We're seeing that. It's pretty analogous, I think, to what happened in 2016, where we had things got pretty dark for a second, but then there was this extraordinary rescue that came out. And we now know that back then, there was a heavy coordinated rescue effort underway, and that fell mainly on the European Central Bank and on the People's Bank of China. Those two entities by far were the most responsible, Japan coming in at a distant third. But ECB and the People's Bank of China, most responsible for bailing out the trouble in 2016. So, could that happen again? Well, turns out the People's Bank of China is currently locked in a major trade spat with the US, and really seems to be in no mood at all to bail anybody out, and may have trouble, may not even be able to bail itself out if things go much further here for them. Different story for another day. And for its part, the ECB does not right now have the political cover to print up several trillions more of euros and of stimulus at the moment. Hey, maybe after a big scare erupts, sure, but by then it may well be too late. The ball will be rolling downhill with a large head of inertia, gathering speed, and it might be unstoppable by the time there's cover for the banks to step back in. It's a possibility. The next downturn, my prediction is going to be very damaging, which is why they are so interested in trying to prevent it from ever getting started. That's what the past year has been about, just constant interventions in word and deed by the central banks to prevent any downward motion from getting started in either the stock or the bond markets. The entire scheme, such as it was, of the central banks rested on the idea that emergency funding would be provided until the global economy took off at a fast enough pace to justify the rescues and also to allow the central banks to undo what they'd done. Balance sheets would be unwound, interest rates would be normalized, which would mean hiking them high enough so that they would be at a meaningful level when the next recession arrived, so those rates could be cut again, right? None of that came to pass. The Fed tried a little bit of hiking, a little bit of balance sheet unwinding, and abandoned both in a matter of months. And there's no interest rate cover in this story right now, right? We're entering this next recession with no bullets left in the interest rate gun. Well, if that won't work, right? Well, then what's left? Printing. Just printing. Money for Main Street this time, probably. Maybe called MMT or modern monetary theory. May come in the form of household tax breaks, maybe even rebates for last year's taxes, maybe a check from the Federal Reserve. We don't know. But all of it funded by more central bank printing. Gold is sniffing something out right now. Perhaps this is it. Perhaps it's the entire mess of financialization run amok, finally crashing into geopolitical realities coupled to trap central banks desperately having to print more just to keep everything from blowing up. Or maybe you're starting to sniff out this idea that endless exponential growth is over and that all of those claims that are outstanding, trillions, hundreds of trillions of stocks and bond claims are all going to get wiped out. Well, if that's true, guess what? You want to be out of those claims and over in the real stuff as fast as you possibly can. And gold is pretty much the only way that a lot of these large funds could even participate in that is a first step. So I think it is the canary in the mine for us on this one. The regime of exponential growth, look, we know it has an expiration date. And its ending is a process, not an event. It doesn't end next Tuesday. It's going to take a few decades to work this one out. But that process has started. That's my view. You are living through it. Your kids and grandkids, born or not, will be dealing with the consequences of it for the rest of their lives. The absolute greatest value proposition for you today is to be able to see all of this coming and pre-position yourself before the masses. Family fortunes are going to be made and lost during this period. Such is the nature of bubbles when they finally burst. By definition, 50% cannot escape the bubble. Heck, 15% can't escape. It's just a numbers game. All you can do is to be early and sneak out before everybody catches on. Hard assets, then, are your new land to explore. Right now, they're still cheap. Imagine what happens, for example, to the puny $17 billion, with a B, total market cap, physical silver market. That's what happens when we take a billion investable ounces of silver and multiply it by roughly $17 an ounce. Think $17 billion. That's it. So imagine what happens to that when the first $1 trillion fund decides to put, I don't know, 0.5% over there into precious metals, including silver. And then imagine what happens when 50 such funds decide to give that a go. Or 100, right? There's so much money out there that when it decides it's going to go into hard assets, the doors are tiny, just tiny. Imagine, for example, what happens when everybody with money in New York City decides it's time to own a farm out in the country, right? Well, that could happen under a very wide variety of reasonable scenarios, and it will just absolutely jack up the prices of things. People go, oh my God, look how much farms cost now. That's not what happened. What happened was people had a preference away from paper assets, the claims. They wanted to own real stuff. And once we stop measuring things in the claims and start measuring it in the real stuff, you'll either say, I have 20 acres in the country, or I don't. That's how we'll measure value again. Someday, just like we used to. Be pretty much a return to the past. Take the time. Just take the time, everybody. Study the information. Back up. Take a really wide view. Think for yourself. Listen to your intuition and what it's telling you. And then take action. Thank you for listening.